Guys, put in a good word for me. I got in trouble.
I mean, it's pathetic.
Podcasting from an underground studio flying under the radar, this is Dan. By day, I'm a professor of cognitive neuroscience, and by night, I retreat into my subterranean lair and dig deep into the thoughts of mankind.
This is the best ever.
And I'm Dave, sitting firmly atop the Great Canadian Shield in Northern Ontario. I'm a pastor by profession, and a part of that includes unmasking the messaging that comes at us each and every day.
We will not conform.
You're listening to the Not Conformed Podcast.
Yeah, Dave, so there you heard both Gracie and Lydia in the intro.
Right on. So did you get her recorded when we were visiting?
That's right. We went down to the subterranean lair, and the girls laid down some tracks.
Excellent, excellent. All right, well, let me just here swirl up my matcha.
Oh, yeah.
You hear that there? Yeah, I got to swirl that up.
Oh, man, we need matcha tonight.
Yeah, exactly. All right, this is as close to psychedelic as I get. And
so what are we doing today?
Well, we're going to do part two of our episode on psychedelics, and I think we're probably going to title this one Psychedelic Evangelism.
Yeah.
Unless something else emerges when we record. But what we want to do is basically briefly review a little bit about what we talked about and extend it a little bit further, especially focusing on this concept of evangelism, that those who use psychedelics are moved to evangelize about them.
Yeah.
So, Dan, why don't you launch in and just briefly review a quick thing about the psychedelic drugs, and I know you got some clips to kind of remind us of what we talked about last time.
Yeah, so in the way of a brief review, the psychedelic drugs include a whole host of substances, and some of these substances occur naturally in plants, and I'm thinking of plants, I'm thinking of substances like peyote, DMT, which is an ayahuasca, muscarin, psilocybin, and ibogaine. And that last one we didn't talk about in the previous episode. Other substances have been synthesized in the laboratory, mainly by pharmaceutical companies. And examples are LSD and ketamine. Again, one which we didn't mention last time.
Yeah, it's a good one to know about, though.
Yeah. So as a quick review of the key features of the psychedelic experience, I have a series of clips here from a movie called DMT, The Spirit Molecule. And it actually stars the podcaster Joe Rogan, though you won't hear him on any of these clips, because each of these clips is a first-person report from what I gather is one of the volunteers in Rick Strassman's DMT study that was conducted in New Mexico. Now, remember, the psychedelic experience includes the mystical state, which is the same state that's involved in Buddhism, yoga, and other Eastern religions. So let's roll with the clips here.
So Dan, just before you roll it, so this is a movie basically with the same title as Rick Strassman's book, right?
Yes, indeed.
That we talked about last show, the DMT, the Spirit Molecule.
Yeah, it's based on the book and on the research described in the book.
All right.
Time crumbles. The linearity of time is totally meaningless in these states. You are at the Godhead, the point where all time folds in on itself.
So time and space seem to distort or even cease to exist in these states.
Yeah, notice that you're at the Godhead. We'll talk about that later.
Yeah.
More and more layers of my humanity start peeling off. Finally, the last layer, and I can't even describe what it is, but you have, at some reaches way in there, there is like the last layer of that which defines you as a human being, and it goes, click. You are no longer a human being. In fact, you're no longer anything you can identify.
So that's an example of ego dissolution, or what we called before depersonalization.
Yeah, and this guy goes even further and says that he was no longer human. He was dehumanized. He can no longer identify, he says.
Wow.
And so I went right into this white light. As soon as I went into it, I lost any sense of being different, any sense of what I was doing, past, any sense of future. It was absolutely blissful and euphoric. And I just felt like it wasn't I. I was everything. I was the light. There was no sense of separation, no shadows, no differences, no past, no future. It was all present and white, yellow light.
It was a lot there, but he says he was everything. There were no distinctions, and he fused with the light, and some people would call that the divine light.
Yeah, and again, the timelessness.
Mm-hmm.
Came as
everything
as well.
Was stripped away. Every hope, every fear, every attachment to the material world was completely stripped out of me. I was free to just be the essence of a soul.
And so notice there were no attachments, and detachment is a part of the Eastern philosophy.
Mm-hmm. And again, you know, these guys can't stay away from theological language, essence of a soul, right?
Yeah.
Disembodiment.
That's definitely interesting.
Just take the body away, just the soul exists.
Mm-hmm.
This is like the actual core of where all of reality is emanating from. This is where meaning comes from. Symbols were pouring out. They were intertwined. Every symbol and letter and in every language was pouring out of this point.
So they feel like they're in contact with the foundation of reality and meaning, the source of all things.
Yeah, notice how there's this emphasis also on the trueness of the experience that, and we talked about this last time, the experience just seems so real by nature. It's experienced as this emotional, experiential reality that is almost incontrovertible.
That's right. It's more real than normal reality.
Yeah.
And yeah, so these are all characteristics of what's called the mystical experience. But remember, in some cases, particularly when using DMT, which is an ayahuasca, sometimes people don't depersonalize, they're present, they enter another realm, and they experience and interact with entities that give them messages and advice. Listen to these examples.
There were all of these machines or structures or things that I had never seen before, that I had no idea what they were. I was like a caveman in a computer lab. I didn't have any idea, but I knew in my intellectual awareness that this was a very advanced civilization or life forms or whatever they were. They were so far advanced from what we know here on Earth.
Some machine-type life forms, Dave.
I reached across and it was suddenly I'm in the universe, in this huge void with these beings on the other side.
And then here's a final one.
And there were these winged beings. I don't remember exactly what they looked, but were like angels, something like angels, that were majestically kind of flying through the space. But there was something about the quality of how they were flying that was unique. I'd never seen anything like it. It was like, I don't know, the sense of another realm that was there. My sense was at some point, there was this implicit sense, this is the divine realm. This is the divine realm. And it was not like a thought, but it was like this implicit kind of grokking recognition.
So he's meeting entities in the divine realm, Dave.
Mm-hmm. We talked a little bit about what these entities could be in the last episode.
That's right.
And we'll talk about that a little bit more further later on.
Yeah, because of course, these could just be hallucinations, right? And some people would just take them as hallucinations. And certainly the neuroscientists would say, oh, these are just figments of the imagination made by, you know, an overactive or some unusual activity in the brain. But it's important to remember that these experiences are very rich in meaning, okay? And they are very similar across individuals. So, for example, under the influence of ayahuasca, people often meet this female entity, and we heard Graham Hancock in the last episode call her Mother Goddess Ayahuasca.
That's right. And the entities have there's a certain robustness in the entities are similar across people's experiences, even across different cultures.
That's right. And so this suggests an alternative interpretation and one that would be consistent with a Christian perspective, and which is that these experiences could involve an interaction with the spiritual world, whereby people are making unsanctioned contact with the spiritual or perhaps demonic realm. And the idea here is that the brain is not just a generative organ. It doesn't just generate consciousness, but it's also a perhaps receptive organ, and that it can be tuned, maybe by the drug, so that it receives information from the spiritual dimension, from the demonic realm.
Yeah, or this, I mean, that's what we would call the demonic realm, or let's just even more neutrally say some kind of spirit realm.
Yes.
Right? Now, one thing that we had criticisms about, or I wouldn't say criticisms, but I got some feedback from a friend of ours who listened to the episode here, and he said, you guys really ought to, there's a lot of people that have negative experiences that do have these clear demonic overtones, or as we would see them as Christians, demonic overtones, and we should include a few more of those. So we ended up cutting a bunch of stuff out of the episode last time because it was getting long, but we don't want to shy away from that because many people do have very negative experiences. And maybe, Dan, you can get into this example of Albert Hoffman, who has this psychedelic trip that clearly has that negative, what as Christians we would call demonic overtones to it.
Yeah, and in the last episode, I only really described the end of his first planned LSD trip, which was, in his description, maybe a little bit more positive. But it turns out that the whole preceding part of the episode had these very deep demonic overtones. And it went like this, quote, "My surroundings had now transformed themselves in a most terrifying manner. Everything in the room spun around, and familiar objects and pieces of furniture assumed grotesque, threatening forms. They were in continuous motion, animated, as if driven by some inner restlessness. The lady from next door, whom I scarcely recognized, brought me milk. She was no longer Mrs. R., but rather a malevolent, insidious witch with a colored mask," quote, end quote. Quote, "Even worse than these demonic transformations of the outer world were the alterations that I perceived within myself, in my inner being. Every exertion of my will, every attempt to put an end to the disintegration of the outer world and the dissolution of my ego seemed so much wasted effort. A demon had invaded me, had taken possession of my body, mind, and soul. I jumped up and screamed, trying to free myself from him, but then sank back down and lay helpless on the sofa. The substance with which I had wished to experiment had vanquished me. It was the demon that scornfully triumphed over my will. I was seized by the dreadful fear of going insane. I was taken to another world, another place, another time. My body seemed to be without sensation, lifeless, strange," end quote. So people in the psychedelic community would call this a bad trip. But this might be really minimizing the experience because there are these very strong demonic overtones. And notice he calls the experience demonic. He uses that word, demonic transformations. And he says, a demon had invaded me. But then he implies that the drug was the demon. But was it really?
Yeah, exactly. Strassman talks about, he actually spends a whole segment of this book wrestling with the negative experiences people have as a result of his experiments and tries to weigh them in light of the beneficial experiences that other people have. And, you know, he talks about this guy who comes back kind of shaken after his trip because he got sodomized by two alligators.
Sodomized by two alligators.
Well, it's funny when you read it, but this guy was, I mean, he was messed up, right? And there's a whole bunch of subjects that had very negative experiences. And even the ones that didn't have negative experiences and didn't drop out of the studies, they talk about being invaded, about having a loss of control, about being taken over, about malevolent beings, using the word malevolent when they encounter these beings. So there's a lot of people that have experiences that are definitely the other side of positive and good feelings and all that kind of stuff. And we do want to emphasize that whatever you hear out there in terms of the positive stuff, there is a dark side to using psychedelics in order to enter these realities.
Yeah, it's funny how these things always end up in like a chapter in the back or something like this, right? Or whenever people talk about this, they say, oh yeah, well, there are these bad trips, you know, every now and then. And they say that's why it's so important to have the proper set and setting. So they're minimizing those quote-unquote bad trips, which really do seem to always have these characteristics of the demonic and possession and so on.
So Dan, one of the very interesting characteristics of the psychedelic experiences is that those who have this experience often feel like they should be telling others to also use psychedelics. They basically become evangelists for psychedelics.
Yeah, you know, people take the drug and they feel compelled. They have to propagate their experience. And we can actually go to some older examples. In fact, in the 1950s, the banker Gordon Wasson went to Mexico to try some psychedelics. And we talked about this in the last episode. And then he came back and he wrote an article in the magazine Life, which is a very popular magazine, to share his experiences and to evangelize, you know, all the benefits of the psychedelics.
Yeah, and then of course you have people like the Harvard professor Timothy Leary, who was extremely zealous, maybe overzealous in his evangelism for LSD. Mm-hmm. And you got modern day popular podcasters like Joe Rogan, who we pointed out last time is repeatedly singing the praises of psychedelics.
Yeah, now we're seeing more and more people posting their personal DMT experiences on YouTube. And some of these take a very evangelistic tone. I have some clips here from a guy who calls himself Shaman Oaks, and his videos about his DMT experiences routinely receive a crazy amount, like 200,000 views.
Wow.
And yeah, and I watched through them, and in an earlier video, he describes how during his DMT trip, he meets this, I think this is one of the initial ones, he meets this powerful female figure, and then he becomes completely obsessed with this woman. And here's a clip of a later trip in which he meets the woman again. And some of this is dramatized, so you'll hear like a woman's voice.
Except this is this really powerful female entity that I feel like I knew before. And I was like, why are you doing this? Why are you acting like you're shy?
I am shy. You've told too many people about me and you're being selfish.
What? So when she calls me out and she says, you've told too many people about me and you're being selfish, it really shocked me. But she was right. Like, I had posted this big thing online and I pretty much shared it with anybody and everybody I could share with complete strangers. And I had decided that I wasn't going to share my DMT with anybody. I bought a certain amount and yeah, I wanted it all for myself. So I'm sitting there kind of feeling weird. I'm feeling bad that yes, I had posted this big long thing on a DMT forum. And I had been selfish. I had decided that I wasn't going to share my DMT with anybody. And then she said this.
You need to bring more people to me.
What? Well, can I tell them about you?
No, I'll tell them.
Huh? I can't tell people about you? Do you know how crazy that makes me sound? Hey, you want to come smoke this? There's something there, but I can't tell you about it. She'll tell you. Who's she? I don't know. Smoke it.
Now, notice, Dave, that he's getting a direct instruction from the entity, this woman, while he's on the drug. And because it feels so real, and for some people more compelling than real life, he begins to feel he must carry out the instructions. Listen to this next
interesting
clip. Yeah.
I became the biggest DMT evangelist you've ever seen. I got any friend that I could find that I could get interested in it, I would go smoke it with them. I would show them how to do it. I would not let them pay me for it. And my only thing was, if you get to meet the lady or whatever happens, please share it with me. Because this is my mission now. Like, this is my goal. It's what she told me to do, is to share her with as many people as I can. And that's all I cared about doing. Shortly after this happened, I told one of my friends, my best friend, I was like, hey, you have to try this. It's crazy. There's this woman I'm not allowed to tell you about her. But you really got to smoke it. It's the most crazy thing. You'll smoke it and you'll go to other dimension. You'll meet this lady. But I can't tell you about her. She told me not to tell you, but she really wants me to tell as many people as I can about her. And he just looked at me like, you know you sound crazy, right? I was like, yeah, I know. But then I got him to smoke it. And then he became the biggest evangelist for it.
Evangelist.
So anybody, yeah. The only people that are going to tell you that it's not cool or awesome or life-changing or whatever are people that haven't done it. If you do
that's us.
You can't not be affected by it.
Oh, you can't not be affected by it, Dave. So he becomes an evangelist for DMT. But what's really interesting, it's not really for the drug. Rather, it's for the entity. It's for this woman he encounters during his trip, right? This amazing woman.
Guy's putting a good word for me. Yeah, I got right. in trouble.
I mean, it's pathetic, right? The guy sounds pathetic. He's like head over heels for this, what probably is very likely a demon.
Well, it is and it isn't, right? Because this is how it goes. So you can either be an evangelist for God or you can be an evangelist for some other entity. But it's the same principle, essentially.
Yeah. He becomes obedient.
And what we're talking about is, I think, you know, even if you don't believe in this kind of stuff, just notice the spiritual language and theological, as in God talk type language that permeates these experiences.
Yeah. Let's imagine for a minute, put the best construction on it and say they're just hallucinations. Well, they still have this profound effect on people where they become evangelists mm-hmm. for this for the entities they experience during the hallucination. And Dave, imagine if the message you receive was of a particular kind, let's say a negative kind, right? Can you imagine how this could go very badly, very quickly? Because we're back to the psychedelic enema.
Psychedelic enema, that's right. And it wouldn't be, I mean, the message wouldn't be go do this bad thing necessarily, but it could be, you know, let's trade, oh, we'll give you some information, but here's what you got to do, right? Or promise of here's how you spiritually evolve yourself as a species or as an individual, here's what you got to go do.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, there's guidance that leads in directions that may not be beneficial for mankind.
Yes, indeed.
All right, so here's another example. This is from a website, or a guy, there's a website run by a guy named Paul Austin called The Third Wave, and it's the subtitle is subtext is Microdosing the Right Way, and he talks about microdosing LSD. And he's got a podcast called The Third Wave, Reframing Psychedelics with Paul Austin, and we've got a few clips from that. And the first clip is an intro to the podcast, and notice the evangelical message in this clip.
Welcome to the Psychedelia Podcast, where we talk about the third wave of psychedelics. Through our many wide-ranging conversations with scientists, policymakers, entrepreneurs, and event organizers, we bring you an exclusive look into the many minds of the psychedelic world. It's time to let the word out about psychedelics and how they can be used as tools to benefit both the individual and the community. Welcome to the third wave.
That's time to spread the word, Dave.
Yeah, absolutely. We could probably learn a few things from these guys, at least into how to get that evangelical zeal from them, right?
Exactly.
So here's another clip from Austin's talk titled Microdosing Psychedelics for Leadership Development. And this is presented at the TNW conference, which is the next web conference in 2017. Okay. And he's advocating for the benefits of microdosing LSD.
Here we go.
So this morning, I took a low dose of a psychoactive substance. The substance is non-toxic, it's non-addictive, and it likely triggers neurogenesis and shows potential for neuroplasticity. This morning, I took a microdose of LSD.
Woohoo! Good for you, Paul Austin. Oh, man.
Yeah, and so he's advocating here for the benefits of microdosing with LSD, which apparently is the rage in Silicon Valley. And again, so let the word out about the benefits of LSD. And here's another clip of his testimony about how good this is.
When I grew up in that home, I grew up in a conservative environment. And so it was difficult for me to have a sense of being in touch with who I was. So I started to get interested in cannabis, and I started to get interested in other illegal drugs. And through that process, I began to discover that there was something to these things. So in June 2015, I started microdosing. Now, since that point in time, over the last 18 months, my life has changed dramatically. So before I began microdosing, I often struggled in social situations, both personal and public. I had an issue with vulnerability, and it was difficult for me to connect with other people. Now, in my professional work environment, I had issues with procrastination and creative resistance. It was challenging for me to really execute well on projects. I could get them done, but they weren't the level of excellence that I wanted. Since I started microdosing, just to give you an overview of how my life has changed, I was able to build and run an online business and remove myself from the day-to-day operations. With my free time, I started The Third Wave, which is a website about psychedelic information and community. And through that process of building the website, I've been fortunate enough to talk to reporters at NOS, The New York Times, The Economist, and The Financial Times.
That's so funny, eh? Before LSD, I was a loser. And now after I started LSD microdosing, now I'm a winner.
So funny. Well, basically, and I'm not sure how a conservative environment means you have to have difficulty having a sense of being in touch with who you are. But
that's weird.
But notice that he starts with marijuana.
Yeah, he does.
Right?
That's the entrance drug. Yeah.
Yeah, we'll talk about that a little bit later. Now, I got one more clip here where he talks about the three waves, and I have some comment to say. So why don't you roll that clip there?
Now, microdosing has been going on for quite a long time in Silicon Valley, really since the 1960s, the second wave of psychedelics. So the first wave of psychedelics was indigenous use across the world for thousands of years. The second wave was the reintroduction of psychedelics to Western society in the 1960s. Now, that reintroduction of psychedelics helped to inspire the ecological movement, the feminist movement, the civil rights movement. But it didn't go so well because it was perceived as the other. It was the counterculture. And for that reason, there was a cultural backlash. Now, we had the science that told us that psychedelics were effective at treating a myriad of mental health issues. And that's where the story begins with the third wave. There's a psychedelic renaissance going on right now. We know that psychedelics are effective at treating PTSD and depression, addiction, alcoholism. And we also know that, more importantly for this crowd, that psychedelics are helpful for things like creativity and personal development.
Oh, he lays on the evangelism here so thick, Dave. And, you know, I got to call this out as psychedelic propaganda. Listen to this.
Recognize the propaganda. If you don't, it's going to change ya.
We got our own propaganda jingle.
Nice. Where did you pull that out of?
That's Anna. That's Anna playing that. Yeah. Nice. She created the jingle for us. But here in that clip, Dave, he talks about three waves. Can you comment on those three waves?
That's right. So the first one was just the indigenous ancient use of psychedelics. And the second wave, notice that he talks about that it inspired the ecological movement. And that makes sense based on what we've heard in psychedelic trip accounts, right? Yes. About Mother Earth and all that kind of stuff.
Mother feminist Earth movement. Ayahuasca.
That's right. Yeah. So the ecological movement, the feminist movement.
Yeah, that's also Mother Ayahuasca.
Yeah, yeah. Very interesting. Right. And these feminine deity type entities, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then the civil rights movement.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Now, how does that one?
Well, interesting, because you think of civil rights, you think of somebody like Martin Luther King Jr., right? But there's an article that I linked in the last episode. It's a BBC article that's titled "The LSD Cult That Transformed America." And it's one that's worth reading because it ties a bunch of stuff in. It really gives a nice background about this second wave. And there's a quote in there that I think clears this up. In 1970, after helping Leary escape a California jail, the Brotherhood gave, so this is this cult, this Brotherhood gave $25,000 to the Black Panthers, who in turn passed it on to the radical left-wing group, the Weather Underground, to smuggle Leary to Algeria and then to Afghanistan. So I think the connection, and I think he's probably right about this, is that the psychedelic second wave is very much connected to this leftist, radical, drug-fueled and socially disruptive element of the civil rights, what they call the civil rights movement, but it's not really what Martin Luther King Jr. would have started.
Right? Yeah, and you mentioned Leary there. That would have been Timothy Leary, the Harvard professor.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
He was very much involved in that.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. And you know what's interesting is that when you go to the URL for this this article, it's usually the URL's got the title of the article in it, and it says the LSD cult that terrified America.
So they changed it.
They must have changed the title, right? It must have been the original title. And then what they basically did was some editor said, no, wait a minute. And they changed it to that transformed America, right? Because that's the message that we want to send out.
Yeah, that's the propaganda.
Right? It's kind of neat. Yeah, so Dan, it seems that psychedelics turn people into evangelists, and sometimes it's overtly, and sometimes that evangelism comes in more subtle ways. And so why don't we talk about the evangelism that goes on in literature and movies and TV shows and that kind of stuff, the stuff that we could call psychedelic pre-programming.
Psychedelic pre-programming, yeah. I know you've got some movies lined up you want to talk about, but first, before you get there, let me just give you an example of this from Aldous Huxley. And it turns out that Albert Hoffman, the creator of LSD, he interacted with Aldous Huxley, the author. I think our listeners are probably now becoming familiar with Aldous Huxley. So he was a famous English author. And Hoffman writes about some of their interactions in his book, and the book's titled LSD, My Problem Child. And he writes the following about Huxley's last novel, which was titled Island. Quote, "This story, set on the utopian island of Pala, recounts an attempt to blend the achievements of natural science and technical civilization with the wisdom of Eastern thought to achieve a hybrid culture in which rationalism and mysticism are fruitfully united. The moksha medicine, a magical drug prepared from a mushroom, plays a significant role in the life of the people of Pala. Moksha is Sanskrit for release, liberation. The drug would be used only in critical moments of life. The young men on Pala ingested it in initiatory rites. It was dispensed to the protagonist of the novel during a life crisis in the scope of a psychotherapeutic dialogue with a spiritual friend, and it helped the dying to relinquish their mortal coil in their transition to another existence." End quote. And then Hoffman writes, quote, "He sent me a copy of Island inscribed, quote, to Dr. Albert Hoffman, the original discoverer of the moksha medicine, from Aldous Huxley," end quote. So the implication, if it's not obvious, is that the moksha medicine that was used ritualistically in this novel Island was in fact LSD.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I did some reading on this, and Huxley's novel was published in 1962. And I did a little bit of a literature search, and what we see already in 1963 is a paper appearing titled, a scientific paper titled Lysergic Acid Diethylamide, so that's LSD, as an analgesic agent by Eric Crass and Vincent Collins. And so they're starting to find or document these positive uses for LSD. And then in 1969, LSD is being used to help the dying. And I have here a paper by Gary Fisher presented in 1969 titled Psychotherapy for the Dying, Principles and Illustrative Cases with Special References to the Use of LSD. So they're already starting to use it in this, what Huxley would call the transition, or what Hoffman called the relinquishing of the mortal coil in the transition to another existence. So Huxley's fiction becomes reality.
Yeah, or at the very least, there's this kind of cross-pollination of the fiction and the research, fiction prepping people for the research, one or the other. It's very interesting how these threads kind of twine together, right? I got another good example from that article that I mentioned earlier, the LSD cult that transforms America. So it's all about this cult. Much of the article is about this cult called the Brotherhood of Eternal Love, and they modeled themselves after Huxley's book, The Island.
Yeah, it's incredible. See how much impact that book had, right? We just think, novel. But it's these novels, they can transform culture.
They took it as a blueprint, and apparently one of the guys even approached the King of Tonga and asked him to provide the Brotherhood with a home. Like they were looking for an island where they could just go out and do this thing.
And do that. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, like just implement it to the letter. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, returning to Hoffman and Huxley, Hoffman writes the following about Huxley's death, which occurred in 1963. So actually right shortly after the release of the novel Island in 1962. Quote, "On his final morning, when he was already so weak that he could no longer speak." So this is Huxley, okay? So Huxley was dying. He was so weak he could no longer speak. Quote, "He had written on a sheet of paper, LSD, try it, intramuscular 100 milligrams, which, by the way, is a high dose. Quote, "Miss Huxley understood what was meant by this, and ignoring the misgivings of the attending physician, with her own hand, she gave him the desired injection. She administered to him the moksha medicine," end quote. And that was what Hoffman wrote in his book. So it seems like the novel predicted the future, and actually this is the way that Huxley left this world, under the influence of LSD, a high dose of LSD.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, there's no doubt that both the Huxleys were interested in shaping society and shaping the future. And you know, since we've started researching this topic, I'm amazed at how much of this psychedelic pre-programming I see popping up all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff that was just, you know, you'd watch it and you'd see it, but now it has a much the context is very clear of what these things are. And so I have a couple of examples from some movies that we could talk about that really illustrate how the psychedelic, these concepts of using psychedelics, of shamanism, are starting to sort of filter into society in ways that you may not see until you can put it together under this kind of evangelism umbrella.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's launch into it.
So the first one is a movie that I'm sure many have seen, and it's Marvel's Black Panther. It won 3 Oscars. It got a lot of accolades. And I have a clip from the opening monologue, and I want you to play it, Dan, and see if you can pick up on the psychedelic themes.
"Millions of years ago, a meteorite made of vibranium, the strongest substance in the universe, struck the continent of Africa, affecting the plant life around it. And when the time of men came, 5 tribes settled on it and called it Wakanda. The tribes lived in constant war with each other until a warrior shaman received a vision from the panther goddess Bast, who led him to the heart-shaped herb, a plant that granted him superhuman strength, speed, and instincts. The warrior became king and the first Black Panther, the protector of Wakanda."
I remember this. It was a very popular movie, yeah.
Oh, definitely. And you notice it's all there in that opening monologue, right? You've got the warrior shaman, right? You got the vision. You got this entity whom they call the panther goddess Bast, right?
It's a goddess.
Yeah, that's right. And you get this heart-shaped herb.
Oh, you got right? A now plant. That's a psychedelic.
Herb. Exactly. And that'll become clear a little bit later. Got another scene that illustrates that a little bit better. And then you've got the way they prepare it also is interesting. But it gives them superhuman strength and speed and instincts, they talk about. Now, another thing it confers, though, is knowledge. And this is implied in the whole thing because they've got this, the kingdom is very technologically advanced. Right, you've got not only did they live where this meteorite of this mythical vibranium landed, but they also have received the knowledge on how to work it and how to become a technologically advanced culture. So it's got all the elements that we've been talking about of these psychedelic experiences.
Yeah, Dave, just a second. Let me interrupt you there for a minute. You mentioned that it's a kind of a combination between shamanism and science. Right. So they have this combination. Well, remember Huxley's novel. Let me go back to the quote from Hoffman. He says, "An attempt to blend the achievements of natural science and technical civilization with the wisdom of Eastern thought to achieve a hybrid culture." So it's the same idea. It's a hybrid culture in which rationalism and mysticism are fruitfully united, he says.
Yeah, you know, we're going to have to, you pushed one of my buttons here. We're going to have to do an episode on this messaging of the merger between science and magic. But let's just leave that. That's a big theme.
Yeah.
Dan, I think you have a you had a clip that we never used last time from Eugene Peterson, where he talks about this business of shamanism and the plants telling them what to do. I think it's, why don't you play that? It's probably relevant here.
Yes, Jordan Peterson.
Yeah. What did I say?
You said Eugene Peterson.
Yeah, he's a Christian author that actually just died recently.
But. Yeah, we're talking about Jordan Peterson from the University of Toronto, the famous / infamous Jordan Peterson. Here's a clip.
Yeah.
And then this is the, I think it's called Banisteria vine, if I remember correctly, and it's what ayahuasca is made out of. And it has this double helix form, which is very, very interesting. And the natives, nobody could figure out how the hell they made this ayahuasca, which transports people spiritually in a very intense manner. And there's a whole religion based on it, like a modern religion as well as the archaic religion. And to make this stuff, they had to take two plants that don't grow anywhere near each other. And like there's like a million plants in the Amazon, so like how do you figure that out? Nobody knows. And then you have to cook them in this very particular way for a particular amount of time before you produce this stuff. So one of the plants has DMT in it, which is a very intense psychedelic, but it's very short-acting. And the other has a MAO inhibitor. So if you take the DMT and you take the MAO inhibitor, then the DMT trip lasts for much longer. And so that's what these Amazonian natives figured out. And no one has any idea how they managed it. And if you ask them, they tell you that the plants told them how to do it, which isn't much of an explanation as far as modern people are concerned. But then when modern people take the ayahuasca, and the plant, so to speak, starts to talk to them, they're a little less leery of the whole theory that the plants had something to do with this.
Yeah, very interesting. It's very similar to this shaman's vision in the movie Black Panther, right?
Yeah, because the plants...
Go get this thing and do it this way.
Yeah, the plants tell them. They get the information from the plants. And Jordan Peterson is trying to make the general point that it's very unlikely that the people would have figured this out on their own.
Yeah.
And so there's something going on there. And Jordan Peterson is just kind of, like, he doesn't know what to make of it, right? But he says, well, this is what it is.
Yeah, but basically the narrative is the same as this opening scene of Black Panther, right?
Absolutely.
Where these guys are guided to do this thing, which they would have never achieved what they achieved had they not followed that vision and done it.
Yes.
Right? Now, this shamanic psychedelic connection becomes even more evident as you keep watching the movie. And there's a scene partway in. It's this post-coronation. There's a duel for the kingship. And after the duel, there's this this burial scene. And what they have to do is they have to give this herb back to, they have to give it to the incumbent, the new king, T'Challa, and they have to bury him physically. And it's to, quote, to restore the powers of the Black Panther and to take you to the ancestral plane. Mm-hmm. Okay, so they give him the herb. He had to get stripped of his powers before they had the duel. And then now they give it to him. They bury him. They completely cover him. He goes to the ancestral plane. He sees these Black Panthers with these glowing demon eyes come down from a tree and morph into his ancestors. And then he has a discussion with his dead father. But again, very, very similar to the kinds of experiences that you would read in Strassman's book or elsewhere about ayahuasca experiences or the shamanic rituals that bring about these experiences, right?
Yeah, because in some of those experiences people experience, they have these regressions almost where they're all of a sudden connected to something in the past or, mm-hmm. these ancestors mm-hmm. in the past. Well, here's a clip, Dave.
You'll be dead in seconds.
Nakia, the herb.
So she asked for the herb.
Yeah, so he's like frozen and basically dead, and they're trying to revive him.
So they're mixing up the herb right now, and here it is.
I call upon the ancestors. I call upon Bast. I'm here with my son, T'Challa. Heal him.
So she's calling on the ancestors.
Yeah, and you notice the CIA Western guy joining in to pray to this entity called Bast, right?
I must bury him. Come in.
So they're burying him right now.
And that's a big part of the shamanic experience, or becoming a shaman, is this burial resurrection thing.
Yeah.
Amaku.
Kamaku.
Amaku.
Kamaku.
So, Dave, what were they saying at the end there? Kamaku or something?
Well, I think, I think that means praise the ancestors. There is a, that's the subtitles, I think, on that.
Yeah, so they're praising the ancestors during this ritual as they've just buried him. They've given him the drug, right? The plant. They bury him, and then they pray and praise the ancestors during this ritual.
That's right. And so certainly in this messaging, you get deeply spiritual overtones to these kind of experiences, whether you know, you want to see them as being purely sort of psychological trips. The messaging that we're getting elsewhere is, no, this is a spiritual thing with spiritual realities, with spiritual entities, right? And you know, Dan, now that I've read all these accounts of people's DMT trips in Strassman's book and elsewhere, I don't know about you, but to me, this is a perfect example of this movie, of the normalization of the use of psychedelics and shamanism to gain knowledge, to gain enlightenment, and to become superior to this, you know, the mass of misguided humanity, which is basically the message of that, one of the messages of that movie.
Yeah, and that way of getting that knowledge through the shamanic experience is equivalent to and dovetails with the knowledge you might obtain, let's say, through science, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Because the science and the shamanism are so intertwined in that movie.
Yeah, and in many other places, like I said, we'll have to talk about that and tease it out from different sources.
Yeah.
And so when you think about it, these are the ideas that a generation is growing up on this, you know, they're growing up on this kind of storytelling, and they're being pre-programmed with these kinds of ideas.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why we kind of call it psychedelic pre-programming.
That's right. And I think in the future, we have to spend more time on movies, because these things aren't put in there accidentally, right? People aren't writing these things and just kind of dreaming this up and just slapping it together. Like they're there on purpose. The wording is carefully crafted to convey a particular message, and we have to deconstruct these.
That's right. And so I've got another movie that actually shows you, it's not much of a movie, but it very much has a messaging, psychedelic messaging. Mm-hmm. And I watched this movie recently, because specifically because I remember that the trailer had this kind of psychedelic overtone, psychedelic content, and so I watched it in preparation for this. And that movie is Lucy. Mm-hmm. It's a 2014 movie directed and written by Luc Besson, the French writer and director.
Oh, he's so messed up. He's so messed up.
Yeah, he's got a lot of movies on this thing. And here's the thing. This thing only grossed about $126 million in the U.S., but globally, it grossed something like $460 million.
Oh, they made a ton
of budget
of
only four. Yeah, on a budget of only $40 million, right? So it was a surprise success. It somehow resonated with people. And I think there's going to be a sequel, I remember seeing, because it made so much money.
Right.
Of course. I mean, who can resist a 10 times to return on their investment, right? So basically here's the plot summary. Lucy is she's this 25-year-old American woman living and studying in Taiwan, and she gets pulled into some shady business through this loser of a boyfriend and ends up being forced to become a drug mule for this Asian gang. And so these bad guys, they surgically implant, they stow this pouch of some new mysterious drug in her lower abdomen. And she's supposed to smuggle. And for whatever reason, and this is kind of there's all these goofy non sequiturs in there, but the boss forgets to tell his henchmen not to mess with this ultra expensive merchandise. And so one of them decides to rough her up before she can actually deliver anything.
No.
And so the pouch ruptures in her abdomen, and she gets exposed to a high dose of this mysterious fictional CPH4. Okay.
So that's the kind of the drug that they focus on, CPH4.
Yeah,
okay.
CPH4. Yeah, and it's made up. The name is made up, certainly. And so to make the long story short, basically this new drug allows her to progressively unlock more and more of her brain capacity until she reaches 100%. It's based on that myth that humans only use about 10% of their capacity, right?
Mm-hmm.
That seems to be everywhere in society. But
yeah, and it's totally false. Like there's no basis in neuroscience that you only use 10% of your brain. So that's just a meme that's out there, and they're just propagating it in this movie.
Yeah, exactly. So why don't you play, just to get a feel for it, play the clip that Lucier took drug.
What are you talking about?
What I'm saying is that your theory is not a theory. I absorbed a large quantity of synthetic CPH4 that will allow me to use 100% of my cerebral capacity. Right now I'm at 28%. And what she wrote is true. Once the brain reaches 20%, it opens up and expands the rest. There are no more obstacles. They fall away like dominoes.
Yeah, so she gets all these powers.
Mm-hmm. And I noticed that they really play on this idea that you can use 100% of your brain, and then all of a sudden when you do that, you gain those powers, right?
Yeah. Roll the next clip, and it'll sort of talk about that.
You can control your own metabolism?
Yes. And I can start to control other people's bodies. Also, I can control magnetic and electric waves.
That's interesting that she can control other people's bodies.
This is the bizarre part, because that's the stage that you're supposed to get at 20%, according to this movie. And why would it be that? You know, we could talk about that. That is definitely a bizarre thing to go to. And again, it has these overtones of demonic possession.
Yeah,
right?
Control, demonic control. Yes.
Yeah, and it comes before, you know, she controls her own body or metabolism. She gets super hearing. She gets super perception. She can control other people. She eventually develops the telepathy and telekinesis and mental time travel and all this stuff. But in all of this, part of the thing that makes the movie move along is that she only has 24 hours to live because this drug is so powerfully active. And it's gonna destroy her body. So she's wondering what to do with all this knowledge. And so she goes to Morgan Freeman, who is this supposed expert on this evolution of humanity going to 100%. And the next clip is Morgan Freeman's advice to her.
I don't feel pain, fear, desire. It's like all things that make us human are fading away.
Hey, doesn't that sound so much like I just interrupted there. Does that sound so much like the psychedelic experience, Dave?
Yeah, absolutely. It is. It's very much like the descriptions we heard in Strassman.
Yeah.
It's like the less human I feel, all this knowledge about everything, quantum physics, applied mathematics, the infinite capacity of a cell's nucleus, they're all exploding inside my brain, all this knowledge. I don't know what to do with it.
If you're asking me what to do, you know, if you think about the very nature of life, I mean, from the very beginning, the development of the first cell divided into two cells. This whole purpose of life has been to pass on what was learned. There was no higher purpose. So if you're asking me what to do with all this knowledge you're accumulating, I say, pass it on. Just like any simple cell going through time.
Dave, does that sound Gnostic to you in the sense that knowledge is the end all and be all? And in fact, because she doesn't feel human anymore, it transcends even humanity.
Yeah, there's definitely that. And there's the evangelistic component, pass it on.
Yes, right? pass it on.
And there's other parts. There's a lot of dialogue in this that is just designed to message. This is a perfect movie that really has just a bunch of action to keep you interested. But then there are these long segments, long dialogue monologues that are really messaging oriented, and they deliver the load, and we could spend a lot of time talking about it. But basically, she eventually hits 100%. She travels to the beginning of time, meets her missing link namesake, and she attains godhood, downloads all her knowledge into this trippy-looking thumb drive, and she gives it to Morgan Freeman at the end, and eventually becomes one with everything.
Oh, yeah. Well, this is the whole right? Eastern notion, right?
Exactly. And this business of, as we've seen in so many psychedelic DMT trips, what happens to people, right? And
yeah,
there's, go ahead.
Yeah, there's this transhumanism theme too, right? That you end up downloading into a machine, but then also you're everywhere. And yeah.
Yeah, there's a, that's another whole other episode when we tackle transhumanism. So good point.
Yeah.
Good point. You know, and the movie itself is really, it's a very visual movie, and it's designed to communicate much of its message visually. And so when you see her, she transforms in these steps going from 10 to 20% sort of in stages. And each of the transformations is visually depicted in basically much the same way that you would imagine a psychedelic user describing their trips, especially those guys that describe being blasted out of a cannon. Well, mm-hmm. they really try to, and the disorientation with gravity and time and space, they really try to communicate that and focus on the distinction that we know we highlighted a few times last episode with the visual being more important than the verbal and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's another clip I have where she's talking to her mom, and it's in this conversation. Now, her mom doesn't know what's going on, but she's essentially describing what's happening to her throughout this drug experience. So maybe you can roll that one for us.
Mom?
Yes?
I feel everything.
What do you mean, sweetie?
Space. The air. The vibrations, the people. I can feel the gravity. I can feel the rotation of the earth. The heat leaving my body. The blood in my veins. I can feel my brain. The deepest parts of my memory.
Yeah, so she goes on. She goes on to describe her childhood experiences and down to being right in the womb, and note again how similar this is to the psychedelic trips that we've heard reports from.
Yes, absolutely, very similar.
Yeah, and then there's an interesting final scene where she's in a lab, and that's when she goes to the 100%, and it's very much a lab scene where she's getting injected with the drug via the IV, similar to the Strassman research, right? So again, this idea that you can do this, you can, you know, do this in a lab setting, it's all being messaged through this medium.
Yeah, and Dave, I remember, if I remember correctly from the movie, she, in that last moment, she sort of is regressed back in time through history. And then maybe, I think she goes to her DNA at one point, maybe, and then she gets blasted into the universe and she sees the whole thing unfolding, right?
That's right. Yeah.
So listen to this DMT participant in one of Strassman's studies.
There is no concept of time. It was so disorienting. I was so terrified. I have never in my entire life been so terrified to be blasted out of my body, to leave my body behind, to be going at warp speed backwards through my own DNA, out the other end, into the universe.
That's so similar, eh?
Yeah, absolutely, right? It's there's no way that you can, that I will believe that this movie... Well, let me put it this way. When I was younger, I'd watch movies like this, and I think to myself, man, those writers are inventive. They're telling these imaginative stories. And now I just think, well, man, these guys are subversive.
Yes.
Because when you see the inspiration behind these stories, you realize it's actually not that imaginative because they didn't just make this up. They're drawing upon a certain kind of inspiration, and they are deliberately and subversively disseminating these ideas to the public.
That's right. And it's coming right out through the media. Dave, I have some clips here from Graham Hancock. So he was the author that we talked about in the last episode. Mm-hmm. And he has a YouTube video. And in this YouTube video, he includes images from the Lucy movie. Let me play a couple clips from this.
All right.
Our society is absolutely designed to shut down 90% of the potential of the human creature. Why should it be the case?
You notice it's the same meme, right? Shut down 90%. We only use 10% of our brain.
Yeah, again, and totally, these, when you watch these are produced to be propaganda videos, because it's Hancock and it's got all these images in the background, and a whole bunch of them, like you said, have images from this movie Lucy. And in fact, that's what triggered me to go and watch it, because I realized, oh, wait a minute, that's got to be a psychedelic movie.
Yeah, and there's so much coordination. It's incredible.
Yeah, yeah.
The society is afraid of realizing human potential. And what it comes down to is special interests. That there are those who run things in society, and that there are those who are there to kind of serve them and serve their ends and serve their needs. And so what our society has created is a realm of unquestioning meat robots who will perform their daily tasks without complaining and without causing any trouble.
Now, it's really interesting, right? Because he's describing basically the notion that we talked about in our previous episodes on propaganda, that there are, in fact, mm-hmm. people, the elites, who are interested in having people basically behave like meat robots that are just subservient to the will of the elites. So there, he might be right on the mark. However, the issue is, what does he see as the solution?
Yeah, and the interesting part is, remember from last episode how Paulin and everybody seems to be very quick to blame conservatives and probably Christians for the shutting down of the second wave. Well, maybe actually there's a different reason why it got shut down, if this guy's right.
Yeah, it's very possible that the elites are using this stuff to access a certain level of knowledge, and they don't want the general public accessing that knowledge yet. But maybe now it's time to unleash that realm.
It's just a theory.
Yeah.
It can be very useful to certain small interest groups, but it's extremely damaging to the rest of humanity. Once we realize our potential, we don't need elites anymore. Who needs elites? Who needs to be led? This is another revelation that comes from working with psychedelics, is we do not need leaders. They are not over us telling us what to do. They may imagine that that's what they're doing, but they have no right to do that. And the moment we begin to wake up and start asking really profound questions about the nature of reality and about the society we live in, their power is instantly diminished. And I think that's why we've seen such vigor and real nasty unpleasantness put into this horrible, wicked thing called the war on drugs, which has been used as an excuse to enter the inner sanctum of people's lives. See, if I'm not sovereign over my own consciousness, if I can't make free choices about my own consciousness, if I can't make those free choices while doing no harm to others, then I am not free in any useful or meaningful sense. And the moment that I free myself, then I become a danger to those who run things in the world. Anybody who has been led to question the nature of things profoundly as a result of psychedelics is a danger to the status quo.
So he sees the psychedelics as a force that frees people, that is going to free individuals and therefore free society, maybe from this elite rule and control.
These psychedelics are agents of liberation. I'm not saying they're all perfect and wonderful and good things, but are they agents of liberation that lead us to ask questions that we would never have asked before? Yes, absolutely.
So this idea that psychedelics will free us and give us knowledge, these are the same ideas communicated in the movie Lucy.
Yeah, there's a lot of things we could pull into this, and we could spend quite a lot of time talking about this. In terms of just even other movies or other TV shows, you've got that movie and TV show Limitless, right? Where basically you have knowledge being gained through drug use, and again, another one of these 10 to 100% brain use.
Yeah.
You've got the movie Luke Cage there's this herb, nightshade, mixed in a special secret way that gives him superpowers, and he takes it in the context of a voodoo ritual that's not Luke Cage, but the I forget what his name is, but the antagonist, the bad guy character in there. Mm-hmm. You've got cartoon, Netflix cartoon, like Last Hope, where there's this guy develops this quantum drive, and it's all about this merger with the machine, so this transhumanism. But the whole thing is described as they activate this drive is very much a psychedelic. It's visualized with in a psychedelic kind of experience. There's many places where you have this psychedelic pre-programming going on.
Yeah.
So
yeah, we have to keep monitoring that for sure.
Very interesting. So Dan, we should talk about the use of psychedelics in therapy and in the treatment of addiction. We did that a little bit with Graham Hancock's account last time, but why don't you talk a little bit about that and how this is going, this evangelism is going on in that area?
Yeah, there's a lot of psychedelic evangelism going on in the scientific domain. Recently, there have been research teams examining the effects of psychedelics on mystical experiences, addiction, and mood disorders at both John Hopkins and at the New York University School of Medicine. So these are massive institutions. Mm-hmm. And the lead researcher at John Hopkins is a guy named Roland Griffiths. He's very important, so remember his name, Roland Griffiths.
Roland Griffiths.
Yeah, and here is a clip from a TED Med talk that Roland Griffiths gives, and TED Med is another part of the TED brand. Here's the clip.
Einstein said that the most beautiful and profound emotion we can experience is the sensation of the mystical. He said, it's the source of all true science.
He says that the mystical is the source of all true science.
Oh, that's a doozy.
All right, here we go.
Today I want to tell you about research with the classic psychedelic psilocybin that's showing that under supported conditions, psilocybin can occasion mystical type experiences associated with enduring positive changes in attitudes, mood, and behavior. The results are fascinating in their own right, have implications for medical therapeutics and implications as well for the nature of consciousness and ethics and altruism.
So in some of his initial work, Griffiths and his team show that psilocybin can induce lasting mystical experiences in a laboratory setting, and they published a whole paper on this. Then he and his team go on to publish a paper titled "Psilocybin Produces Substantial and Sustained Decreases in Depression and Anxiety in Patients with Life-Threatening Cancer, a Randomized Double-Blind Trial." And in that paper, they claim that psilocybin leads to mystical experiences which then cause a reduction in depression and anxiety of these cancer patients. And then in later work, in another paper, Griffiths and his team show that psilocybin led to high rates of long-term smoking cessation. So evidently, psilocybin can free people from addiction. Now, the conclusion we're being sold by Griffiths and many others is that psychedelic drugs have overwhelmingly positive effects. They're life-changing. Sometimes they use the word miracle cures, and they may be perfect end-of-life transition drugs. And here is Peterson's summary after describing some of the psychedelic research. So this is Jordan Peterson.
Mm-hmm. Now, why am I telling you all this? Well, I'm telling you for a variety of reasons. The first is, make no mistake about it. Human beings have the capacity for forms of consciousness that are radically unlike our normative forms of consciousness. And the evidence that those alternative forms of consciousness are purely pathological, which is the simplest explanation, right? You perturb a system, it produces pathology, that's negative. That is the simplest explanation. The evidence for that is weak at best, leaving out the bad trip issue, which is non-trivial. The empirical evidence as it accrues, in fact, seems to suggest that the consequence of positive mystical experiences associated with psychedelic intake is overwhelmingly positive, even in extreme situations. And you really can't find a more extreme situation than uncertain cancer diagnosis with concomitant and depression and anxiety. Like, I mean, that's not as bad as it gets, but it's kind of in the ballpark.
So Peterson is a real evangelist here. He says you can't get better than psychedelics.
Nice. We got to add him to the list of psychedelic evangelists along with Michael Pollan and Joe Rogan.
Well,
and the company,
speaking of Michael Pollan, here's Michael Pollan.
If it works. Right. And so it'll be a big change. And as many of the researchers will tell you, if you ask them, this could be a revolution in mental health care.
A revolution in mental health care.
Uh-huh.
And here is Roland Griffiths concluding his TED Med Talk on an evangelical note.
Excitingly, exploration of the psilocybin occasioned mystical experience seems to provide a model system for rigorous and prospective investigation of these awakening experiences. Further research will surely reveal underlying biological mechanisms of action, will likely result in an array of therapeutic applications. And more importantly, because such experiences are foundationally related to our moral and our ethical understandings, further research may ultimately prove to be crucial to the very survival of our species.
Yeah, crucial to the very survival of our species. So what you're seeing here, I think, Dave, at the end, is a very strong call to action. It's very evangelistic, right? We got to study these psychedelics because they're going to solve, potentially species-ending type problems.
Yeah, and again, one of the things to pick up on here is that people that are collectors or pursuants of these experiences don't think of them as just simply psychological head trips. They absolutely see them as spiritual realities.
Yes. Now, even Jordan Peterson is amazed by the fact that Griffiths was able to get approval for his studies with psilocybin, get ethics approval. Here's a clip from him.
The effects of psilocybin were studied in 51 cancer patients with life-threatening diagnosis and symptoms of depression and or anxiety. I cannot imagine how they got this through an ethics committee. It's just, we're going to take people who have uncertain diagnosis of cancer that are potentially life-threatening, and we're going to give them psychedelics. It's like, but they did it. They did it. And I think it's a testament to Griffith's stature as a researcher that was allowable.
Yeah, how did they get clearance and the funding? And I think most people think, well, you know, he was a good researcher. He had a great idea. He wrote a grant application. He submitted an ethics application. And off it goes, just like regular research. But interestingly, in his book, Michael Pollan unpacks the history of all of this. And what he reveals is a different narrative, namely that there was some orchestration behind the scenes that made all of this possible. Now, according to Pollan, before the recent research by Griffiths and others, some of the more enthusiastic players in the psychedelic movement would meet at a retreat center in California called the Salen Institute, and I think I pronounced that correctly. And Pollan writes the following, quote, "By the end of the meeting, the Salen group had settled on a short list of objectives, some of them modest, to draft a code of ethics for spiritual guides, and others more ambitious, quote, to get above board, unimpeachable research done at an institution with investigators beyond reproach, and ideally to do this without any pretext of clinical treatment," end quote. All right. So they had this plan, and this was before all these recent studies. And then, according to Pollan, some in the group were told by one of the attendees that the well-known researcher Roland Griffiths is precisely the investigator beyond reproach, quote unquote, and the scientist of the first order, quote unquote, the group was looking for. So Griffiths, Dave, Griffiths was actually chosen. He was chosen for a reason. Okay?
Interesting. Interesting.
Yeah, the group was told that Roland Griffiths was into meditation practices, and so he might be open to doing research on psychedelics. And I think I have another clip here where Griffiths is talking about how his meditation practices were related to his work.
About 20 years ago, I started a meditation practice that profoundly shifted my worldview and got me very curious about the nature of spiritual experience. I became reacquainted with research conducted mostly in the 1950s and 60s, showing that under some conditions, classic hallucinogens like psilocybin could occasion mystical experiences that look very much like those that occur naturally and that have been reported by mystics throughout the ages.
You notice, Dave, he says, He started meditating, and it shifted his worldview. And it brought him to get interested in psychedelics, right? So this is, we're seeing this theme over and over again. These are worldview shifting sorts of things. Well, it turns out that choosing Griffiths had other benefits, because a few pages earlier, Pollan writes the following, quote, Curtis Wright, a new administrator at the FDA, and as it happens, a former student of Roland Griffiths at Hopkins, had signaled that research protocols for psychedelics would be treated like any other, judged on their merits. So Griffiths was well known in the research field. He was into Eastern meditation practices, and he had a connection, one of his former students, in the FDA. This guy was the perfect guy for the job, right?
Well, nice.
You know, I think the key important point here is that some of the guys in the early psychedelic community and the early psychedelic movement had and have very specific long-term goals. Okay, so there's an agenda at play. And one of these early guys was named Rick Doblin. And Pollan writes the following, quote, after experiencing with LSD as an undergraduate and later with MDMA, which is another psychedelic drug, Doblin decided his calling in life was to become a psychedelic therapist. He decided he'd better first get a doctorate in public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School. There he mastered the intricacies of the FDA's drug approval process, and in his dissertation plotted the laborious path to official acceptance that psilocybin and MDMA are now following, end quote. Okay, so this guy was basically took LSD and then decided, oh, you know, we got to make these things approved by the FDA. So he, as a part of his dissertation, he drafts the plan.
The plan, yeah, how to get it done.
That's right. Now,
yeah, and it's interesting because in Strassman's book, he talks about the torturous path that he had to take just to get approval to do human studies and to get human grade even made, because he couldn't. It was just a big circle. It was a convoluted process that he had to go through to get it done.
Yeah, so, and Pollan actually calls that his work a watershed moment, that it was possible to do that research. So he factors into all that. But this guy, Rick Doblin, okay, then founds MAPS, which stands for Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. And here's a clip of Doblin telling us about the goals of MAPS. Listen very carefully.
MAPS is, in essence, a change agent using pharmaceutical science as the point of leverage into our society, but the goals go way beyond that.
So MAPS is a change agent, okay, and it's used as leverage into society, and then he has bigger plans that go beyond just the clinical use. What he's looking for, right, is the acceptance of psychedelic use in society as a matter of normal course.
Oh, wow. Dan, there's a really interesting, I don't have a clip, but I have a couple of quotes from the that Lucy movie where they talk about just this. And it's interesting how this kind of messaging is just inserted in there. It's in that lecture by the Morgan Freeman character. Mm-hmm. And he's talking about his theory of going from 10% to 20%, blah, 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 all this stuff. And
he's a professor, right?
Yeah, he's this professor that is the expert on this supposed brain development thing.
Yeah.
And so he's expounding his theory, and some student asks in the lecture, and he says, sir, has this been proven scientifically? And he says, for the moment, it's just hypothesis, I confess. And then he goes on, he says, but if you think about it, it's troubling to realize that the Greeks, the Egyptians, and the Indians had notion of cells centuries before the invention of the microscope. And this is a theme we'll have to pick up, this indigenization thing we'll have to pick up later. But then he says this, what to say about Darwin, whom everybody took for a fool when he put forth his theory of evolution? And here's the money quote. It's up to us to push the rules and laws and go from evolution to revolution.
He gets
this big applause and laughter from all the people sitting there. But this message of it's up to us to push the rules and the laws to go from evolution to revolution.
Yeah, there's an agenda. Listen,
agenda,
Paul,
right?
Yeah, Pollan writes, quote, for Doblin, so back to Doblin, for Doblin, winning FDA approval for the medical use of psychedelics, which he believes is now in view, for both MDMA and psilocybin is a means to a more ambitious and still more controversial end. The incorporation of psychedelics into American society and culture, not just medicine. This, of course, is the same winning strategy followed by the campaign to decriminalize marijuana, in which promoting the medical use of cannabis changed the drug's image, leading to a more general public acceptance, end quote. So notice the role of marijuana again. It's paving the way.
Interesting.
Notice the strategy, Dave. First, you get medical acceptance. That imbues the drug with goodness, right? And then you build on that to promote broader use of the drug and broader acceptance of the drug in society.
Yeah, wow. Doesn't that sound like something going on right now?
Well, exactly. That's what's one could imagine. That's what's happening here in Canada with the legalization of marijuana. It's a step in a longer term process. Yeah. So I don't know. Looking back at this now, it seems that to some extent it's been mission accomplished because a few scientific studies have already been completed, and now advocates of the psychedelic agenda can point to the undeniable success of the scientific studies. Here is Jordan Peterson. Listen to this rhetoric.
I'm loath to talk about this because I'm not an advocate for drug use.
Oh, he's loath to talk about it. He doesn't want to advocate drug use, but listen to what he actually says.
This is dragging him to this kicking and screaming, clearly.
That's right. Reluctantly, yes. Here we go.
But by the same token, you can't ignore empirical data. It's not reasonable. And the empirical data that psychedelic substances can produce mystical experiences and that those often have a transformative effect. I mean, one of the latest studies showed that if you took people who were dying of cancer and you gave them psilocybin in a sufficient dose to produce a mystical experience, that you radically decreased their fear of death. It's like, you got to think about that, man. That's tough. That's a tough experiment. You just wouldn't expect that. You think you take someone, you derange them intensely, and then when they come back, they're not, even though they're dying, they're not nearly as afraid of dying. You know, you got to kind of wake up and smell the roses when you see something like that. And the people who are doing this research are very reliable people.
Yeah, so now the psychedelic advocate can say, look, the science proves that psychedelics are good. And so if you reject them, you're a science denier. You're not reasonable, as Peterson says, right? The benefits of the drug can't be denied. So Peterson and Griffiths and Pollan, they're all leveraging the scientific data to promote the mystical experience and the psychedelic drugs and to promote their use in broader society. That is propaganda.
Recognize the propaganda. If you don't, it's going to change
you. All right, Dan. So there's one more segment that I want to do here, dealing with this emerging trend that we really should mention, and that's the push to incorporate psychedelics into the education system.
Oh, yeah. Psychedelics and education.
Yeah. So I have this clip from that Third Wave podcast, which we mentioned earlier, and in which the host interviews Dr. Kenneth Tupper. Now, according to the Third Wave webpage, Dr. Tupper became interested in psychedelics after reading Aldous Huxley's novel Island.
Oh, Aldous Huxley's back again. This guy's having back massive again, influence.
That's right. So Tupper completed his PhD at Simon Fraser University in British Columbia, and it was on the inclusion of psychedelics in education.
For a PhD, my goodness.
And so evidently he went to Brazil to partake in an ayahuasca ceremony. I remember this interview because he talks about how he couldn't write the last bit in his dissertation because it was prior to Trudeau coming into office. And the church that was trying to import ayahuasca as their sacrament, they couldn't get it in because the Harper government had just, they put a kibosh on that, right?
Oh, yeah.
And so he says, you know, that the allowing the permit for this church to get their ayahuasca sacrament was just came in just after he defended his dissertation. So at present, he is director of the British Columbia Center of Substance Abuse. He's also the adjunct professor at the University of British Columbia School of Population and Public Health, and he's an adjunct assistant professor in the School of Child and Youth Care at the University of Victoria. Okay, so here's the clip.
you know, it's interesting for us to reflect on whether there are mechanisms or tools that could be used as part of the, I would say later in the educational process, because I don't, you know, I think there is probably a developmental stage at which we most appropriately introduced. I mean, discussion about exactly what age cutoff would be appropriate, but it probably it depends partly on individuals. But something like a experiential education in late teens, early 20s, experiential education programs like Outward Bound mm-hmm. could potentially incorporate, for example, an entheogenic or psychedelic experience, perhaps a, you know, an ayahuasca ceremony or peyote ceremony or something that's equivalently going to allow for that catalyzation with these very powerful and ancient cognitive tools that would build upon the kinds of learnings that have already had taken place in, say, for example, a week out in the wilderness, sometimes spent in a bit of like a almost spirit quest where one's sort of in nature alone for a night or two, but then perhaps structured ceremonial context for an entheogenic experience would be a mechanism or vehicle. You know, I wouldn't necessarily say it would be something to be integrated fully into the modern public schools as we know it, but perhaps an optional additional type program, just as Outward Bound is.
Yeah, so give the children psychedelics and then take them on a spirit quest.
Hey, isn't this what most Americans call going to college?
Yeah. That's right. That's the college experience in, probably many places in the world. Well, Dave, I've got two thoughts on this, okay? So, okay, first one is that we may very well see a greater push for the inclusion of psychedelics into the education system as the indigenization agenda picks up steam. There will likely be some attempt to integrate indigenous forms of knowledge, which might involve the use of various ceremonial drugs as a way of accessing knowledge. Okay, because I think with these indigenization initiatives, it's so hard for me to say, it's not just that we're trying to integrate the indigenous population more into, let's say, the university or into the Western culture. What we're also saying is that the university and the Western culture have to accept and adapt to the indigenous way of thinking, and that includes taking on and validating their forms of knowledge. So I think that trend is probably going to be emerging. And the second thought I had is that since Tapper was inspired by Aldous Huxley, we shouldn't be surprised to learn that Huxley was a proponent of the use of psychedelics in education. And in his book, Doors of Perception, in which he discusses his trip on mescaline, Huxley says the following about education, quote, "Under a more realistic and less exclusive verbal system of education than ours, every angel," in Blake's sense of the word, and by the way, he means like bad angel, because Blake talked about bad angels, so bad kids, "would be permitted as a sabbatical retreat, would be urged, and even if necessary, compelled to take an occasional trip through some chemical door in the wall into the world of transcendental experience." Okay, so in other words, take a psychedelic drug. "If it terrifies him, it would be unfortunate but probably salutary. If it brought him a brief but timeless illumination, so much the better," end quote. So what he's saying there is that he's even used the word compelled, that children ought to be compelled to take psychedelics to give them some illumination, or at least to freak them out with the experience.
Yeah, that's a little bit horrifying.
Yeah, and you can imagine that if that starts to get incorporated into the entire system, all those things that we were talking about, you know, potentially that these drugs actually open maybe a door to the demonic realm, right? This could have a massive impact on the children and therefore on the entire society.
There you go, another argument for homeschooling.
That's right. That's what we want to be homeschooling, just to keep them away from the psychedelic drug trips, for Pete's sakes. So Dave, I think we're way over time right now. Let's just close it up with a quick summary.
Okay, go for it.
Yeah, it seems that the psychedelics make people into psychedelic evangelists. And then these people go and they start evangelizing to the rest of the world, trying to get them to use psychedelics. And it happens through the movies and through novels, as we saw with Aldous Huxley's novel and the various movies that we covered. The evangelism also takes place through academia, through the scientific sphere, and it also happens through education. So we're seeing this multifaceted propaganda program to try to get society to accept and use psychedelic drugs.
Yeah, and going forward, I think over these last two episodes, we've done a good job of mapping the landscape of this, what we could call the psychedelic worldview, or what we might actually end up calling the shamanic worldview. And in the future episode, we want to take a little bit more of a critical approach and deconstruct some of the assumptions and the founding cornerstones of this worldview.
Yeah, we'll spend some more time on shamanism and how that's being propagated into our culture right now. I think some listeners will find that intriguing, if not completely mind-blowing. So Dave, why don't you take us out by reminding everybody where they can find us and how to reach us?
Okay, so you can find us on the web at notconformshow.ca or notconformshow.com. I think we're going to emphasize the .ca URL, being Canadian and all that. And both of those are just basically going to redirect you to our Simplecast show page. And there you can find detailed show notes for each of our episodes, complete with a bibliography and links to the books and articles and YouTube videos, you name it, all the stuff that we referred to on the show. And frankly, this is a great resource for those who want to further explore any of the topics that we talk about. You'll also find links to our social media and our RSS feed. Quick note about that, Simplecast just upgraded to version 2.0, and so now we have a new RSS feed. And that shouldn't be a problem if you've already subscribed, but if you need to resubscribe, the old feed's not going to work, or if you're passing that manual subscription link along, please make sure you have the latest RSS feed URL. There are also links there to help you find us on iTunes, Google Podcasts, and in many of your favorite podcast players. So if somebody goes to the page, you can just click and it'll automatically send you to the right places. Or, of course, you can listen online with our great with that great Simplecast embedded player that's on the webpage as well. And that's notconformshow.ca. And basically, the website is the best way to spread the word about the show. You can also reach us by email at info@notconformshow.ca and email us if you have any comments, tips, suggestions for topics, or if you're finding that something isn't working in your favorite podcast app. We definitely want to hear from you so that we can get to the bottom of that and fix things to make it as easy as possible to bring new listeners on board. And one final note, our current schedule for releasing roughly every 2 weeks would have us recording as of now on Easter weekend, which may not be possible. So it's quite possible that the next episode might be a few days later than the expected 2 week arrival. Okay. And I think that's it, Dan.
Yeah. And we want to remind our listeners to please share this podcast with your friends, with your associates, with your colleagues. We really depend on you to spread the word for us so that we can increase our listenership. And with that, Dave, we'll talk to you later.